Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Rising global inflation is expected to hit emerging and developing economies particularly hard this year, adding to a confluence of crises that threaten us all, the UN's acting human rights chief has warned. Addressing the Human Rights Council on Thursday, Nader al-Nashif said that the world's poorest nations faced average inflation rates of 9.5% this year, well above the 6.6% rate expected in the industrialized world. Ms. al-Nashif added that although the world's richest countries had seen employment rates return or exceed pre-pandemic levels by the end of 2021, most middle-income countries hadn't yet managed to recover from the COVID-19 crisis.
The COVID-19 pandemic has exposed and exacerbated pre-existing inequalities, setting back development by several years in many parts of the world, weighed down by unsustainable debt burdens and their repercussions for providing social protection. Many countries face unprecedented challenges, including the possibilities of social unrest.
75 to 95 million more people are expected to live in extreme poverty this year, compared with before the pandemic, Ms. al-Nashif said. Of the 760 million people already enduring extreme poverty, she explained that there would be 16 million more women and girls than men and boys this year. More than 80% live in only two regions, sub-Saharan Africa and Central and South Asia, she said. In a related warning, a top independent human rights expert called on Thursday for the creation of a global recovery fund to help states hit hard by extreme weather events caused by climate change. Ian Fry, the UN Special Rapporteur on Climate Change, issued his appeal at the end of an official visit to Bangladesh. He insisted that the Southeast Asian nation should not have to carry the burden of climate change alone, and he added that for too long, major emitting countries have denied their responsibility for the suffering they're causing. The rights expert, who was appointed by the Human Rights Council in an independent capacity in March this year, said that repeated flash flooding this year in Sylhet, northeast Bangladesh, had exposed women in particular to the most dangerous impacts of climate change. To Sri Lanka, where the country's economic crisis has left women at a higher risk of domestic violence, the UN Sexual and Reproductive Agency, UNFPA, has said. Amid fuel shortages, the UN agency quoted the owner of a women's refuge who said that she didn't have enough funds to fetch a victim who'd called for help. The case is one of many in the country where a lack of work has multiplied problems for families, including more violence for women, the UNFPA said. Official data indicates that one in four women in Sri Lanka has been a victim of domestic violence. The UNFPA is concerned that the country's once robust healthcare system is close to collapse and that as government funds run dry, shortages of critical medical supplies have severely obstructed sexual and reproductive services, access to contraception and safe houses for women. To help women's shelters in Sri Lanka, the UNFPA has appealed for $10.7 million to ensure specialized healthcare and gender-based violence protection services for more than 2 million women and girls this year. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio.
We celebrate Constitution Day and FFRF's National I'm an Atheist and I Vote campaign.
Mandisa Thomas with Black Nonbelievers joins us. Then UK therapist Jimmy Bangash,
who tells his personal terror story about coming out as gay to his Muslim family.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Immigrant justice advocates are denouncing ongoing efforts by Republicans to send dozens of buses full of asylum seekers to sanctuary cities across the United States. On Thursday, about 100 asylum seekers from Colombia, Cuba, Guyana, Nicaragua, Panama, and Venezuela were dropped off in front of Vice President Kamala Harris's residence in Washington, D.C. The buses were sent from Texas by Republican Governor Greg Abbott. This is an asylum seeker from Venezuela.
It was a very long trip, quite tough. We didn't expect to be left adrift here without knowing where to head to. Our objective is to reach New York.
Asylum seekers were on the road for over 30 hours. At least two of them, including an infant, were taken to the hospital while others were able to get food and shelter. Carla Bustillos is an immigrant rights advocate in Washington, D.C.
So while we're doing this political show, we have human beings feeling that their suffering is being exploited. They have come to the United States to seek asylum, and they have been told to get on these buses and promised that an organization would receive them here, give them food, shelter, and a job.
This comes after Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis sent two planes with some 50 asylum seekers to Martha's Vineyard, an island off the coast of Massachusetts. DeSantis spoke Wednesday.
Yes, if you have folks that are inclined to think Florida's a good place, our message to them is we are not a sanctuary state, and it's better to be able to go to a sanctuary jurisdiction. And yes, we will help facilitate that transport for you to be able to go to greener pastures.
Community members in Martha's Vineyard welcomed the asylum seekers with food, water, and other resources. Many had journeyed for months until reaching the U.S.-Mexico border in search of refuge and were lied to by Florida officials, told if they boarded the planes, they'd be sent to Boston to receive jobs and housing. On Thursday, the White House condemned Republican governors for using asylum seekers as, quote, political pawns. The United Nations Human Rights Office says it will send monitors to Izium after hundreds of bodies were reportedly discovered in mass graves by Ukrainian forces who retook the city from Russia earlier this month. Ukraine's defense ministry said the largest of the mass burial sites contained 440 unmarked graves and said most of the victims are civilians. In Kyiv, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen met Thursday with President Volodymyr Zelensky, pledging European Union support to Ukraine, quote, for as long as it takes. Von der Leyen's pledge came as the Biden administration said it's sending another $600 million in military aid to Ukraine. On Thursday, Russia's foreign ministry warned the U.S. against providing longer-range missiles to Ukraine.
We have repeatedly stated that pumping Ukraine with Western weapons leads to a prolongation of hostilities and new casualties among the civilian population. Moreover, this brings the situation closer to the dangerous line of a direct military clash between Russia and NATO countries.
Russian President Vladimir Putin met Thursday with Chinese leader Xi Jinping at a regional summit in Uzbekistan. A Chinese foreign ministry statement after the meeting made no mention of the word Ukraine, but Putin said Xi told him that Russia needs to, quote, demonstrate the responsibility of a major country to play a leading role and inject stability into a turbulent world, unquote. Putin hinted at strains in the Russian-Chinese relationship by referring to President Xi's questions and concerns about Ukraine.
We highly value the balanced position of our Chinese friends when it comes to the Ukraine crisis. We understand your questions and your concern about this. We'll, of course, explain our position.
Putin also pledged Russian support for China's territorial claim on Taiwan. The Xi-Putin summit was their first face-to-face meeting since Russia invaded Ukraine. It was also President Xi's first trip outside China since the start of the pandemic. In Pakistan, waterborne and mosquito-borne diseases are surging after unprecedented monsoon rains and glacial melt left a third of the nation underwater. Doctors in the southern Sindh province report a big rise in cases of malaria, severe gastric infections, more than 4,000 cases of dengue that have led to at least 9 deaths.
Dengue is spreading fast these days. Out of every 100 patients, 90 are suffering from dengue. Some of them come here with severe symptoms.
Pakistan's floods have killed nearly 1,500 people, displaced an estimated 33 million. This week, climate experts at the World Weather Attribution Initiative reported climate change increased the intensity of Pakistan's record rainfall by up to 50% during the flooding. Back in the United States, a House Congressional Committee has uncovered documents revealing how oil company executives' private actions contradicted their public promises to fight climate change. One set of emails obtained by the House Committee on Oversight and Reform shows how Exxon sought to undermine an oil industry pledge to uphold the Paris Agreement. Other internal emails reveal Shell's public pledge to go carbon neutral amounted to corporate greenwashing. This week, lawmakers heard testimony on how public relations firms work to mislead the public over the climate crisis while organizing phony grassroots campaigns to battle proposed regulations. This is environmental lawyer Raya Salter.
Climate crisis is an unprecedented global crime, and the smoking gun lies in the hands of big oil and gas. They have known with precision for over 40 years that they were doing no less than creating a mass extinction event.
A court in Louisiana has revoked air permits for a massive petrochemical complex in a region of the state known as Cancer Alley for its large number of polluting industries. The defeat of Formosa Plastic Corporation's proposed $9.4 billion plant is a major victory for local environmental justice groups, including the Louisiana Bucket Brigade and Rise St. James, who've spent years fighting the project. In Wisconsin, a federal judge has ruled in favor of an indigenous tribe on the south shore of Lake Superior after a challenged construction of Enbridge's Line 5 pipeline. Judge William Conley found the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Tribe of Chippewa Indians acted within its rights when it revoked permission in 2013 for the pipeline to cross tribal territory. The judge ruled the company's trespassing and must pay damages. Mississippi has lifted a boil water advisory for Jackson 40 days after the state's Department of Health reported the city's water supply was unsafe to drink. The problem was compounded in August when torrential rains caused the Pearl River to overtop its banks, flooding Jackson's main water treatment plant. Republican Governor Tate Reeves said Thursday tap water in Mississippi's capital city is now safe to drink, though he admitted the system is, quote, still imperfect. The head of Mississippi's chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics warns Jackson area caregivers preparing baby formula should continue to use bottled water because infants remain at risk of heavy metals or other toxins in the water supply. The billionaire founder of Patagonia has given the outdoor apparel company away to a specially designed trust and a nonprofit that will use all the revenue to combat the climate crisis and protect the environment. Yvan Chouinard founded Patagonia nearly 50 years ago. The company is valued at about $3 billion. In an interview with the New York Times, he said, quote, instead of extracting value from nature and transforming it into wealth for investors, we'll use the wealth Patagonia creates to protect the source of all wealth, he said. The World Health Organization has given its most upbeat assessment on COVID-19 since declaring the disease an international emergency in January of 2020. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said Wednesday the number of newly reported infections has dropped dramatically.
Last week, the number of weekly reported deaths from COVID-19 was the lowest since March 2020. We have never been in a better position to end the pandemic. We're not there yet, but the end is in sight.
This week, the number of global confirmed COVID-19 deaths topped 6.5 million. But the WHO reports the number of excess deaths during the first 2 years of the pandemic totaled nearly 15 million. A federal judge has rejected a request by the Justice Department to resume its investigation into documents seized by the FBI from Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida. On Thursday, U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon upheld her earlier ruling, which bars the Justice Department from further examining the documents, many of which are marked top secret, until a special master has a chance to review more than 11,000 pages. She also formally named retired federal judge Raymond Deary to the position. The ruling will add lengthy delays to the Justice Department's criminal probe into Trump's mishandling of government records. Judge Cannon was nominated to the federal bench in 2020 by then President Trump. Senate Democrats have once again delayed debate on a bill to ban lawmakers and their families from trading stocks. On Thursday, Oregon Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley told Business Insider any vote on the congressional stock trading ban will have to wait until after November's midterm elections. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren responded, quote, "Every day we delay on passing meaningful restrictions on stock trading among members of Congress is a day that further erodes the credibility of this body," she said. Ethics watchdog Walter Schaub of the Project on Government Oversight accused Senator Merkley of slow-walking the legislation until the Senate's calendar runs out. This week, the New York Times reported at least 97 current lawmakers or their close family members have bought or sold stocks or other investments that intersected with their legislative committee work. El Salvador's President Nayib Bukele announced Thursday he will seek re-election despite the Salvadoran Constitution's ban on consecutive presidential terms. The Salvadoran Constitution limits each term to 5 years. Bukele's announcement came 1 year after he and allies appointed new judges to the Salvadoran Supreme Court in an effort to allow Bukele's illegal re-election efforts. His government has been accused of severe human rights violations, including the arbitrary detention and torture of people accused of being in gangs. His term is set to end in 2024. And in Mexico, a retired general and at least two other members of the military were arrested Thursday in connection with the 2014 disappearance of 43 students from Ayotzinapa. Retired Army General Jose Rodriguez Perez was the commander of the military base in Iguala, Guerrero, when the students were ambushed and kidnapped. Last month, a truth commission established by the Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, confirmed the military's involvement in the crime and said their disappearance was a crime of the state. Mexico's former attorney general, Jesús Murillo Caram, who served under former President Enrique Peña Nieto, was also arrested in August. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
Radio with co-host Stan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. See if you try. No hell below us.
Gaylor, and welcome all you secularists who know that a secular government free from religion is a necessity to safeguard all individual liberties. And so we must all celebrate and safeguard the godless and entirely secular U.S. Constitution. And Constitution Day is Saturday, September 17th. That marks the 235th anniversary of the signing of our secular constitution. And we're going to talk more about that in our exciting national secular voter campaign later on the show.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. Annie Laurie and I are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. This is the September 15th edition of Free Thought Radio. Grant Blaschka is our engineer today. He's with Audio for the Arts. He's in the Stephen Uhl Friendly Atheist Studio right here in Free Thought Hall, which is the national office of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin.
And Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, where we tell you what we've done in the past week and comment on all of the relevant news of the week. FFRF has two purposes: to keep religion out of government, out of social policy. We seem to be having a lot of trouble making sure that happens right now in the United States.
And out of bedrooms.
Out of bedrooms, out of our lives. And we also educate you, the public, about the views of non-believers. And we have some exciting news on that front that we'll talk about also, the growth of the NONES, the nuns. And if you want more information and you want to join our 38,000-member strong group, please go to FFRF.org.
I think it's almost 39,000, and last time I checked the numbers. Our guest in the second half of today's show will be Jimmy Bangash. He's a psychotherapist who grew up in a Muslim family in the UK. He now counsels ex-Muslims and people in Muslim-oriented communities dealing with discrimination and persecution for blasphemy, apostasy, and homosexuality.
And so we have a lot to talk about on this show and some fun things. But first, we want to tell you that we will be talking briefly with Mandisa Thomas. She's founder and president of Black Nonbelievers, about their upcoming Women of Color Beyond Belief conference at the end of the month in Chicago.
And we'll talk with her in just a few minutes. We have a TV show besides the radio show. The TV show is called Free Thought Matters. And our guest this week is the author, Anthea Butler. She's an African-American professor of religion, and she's the chair of the University of Pennsylvania Department of Religious Studies. She's a contributor to the 1619 Project, and she wrote the book, White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America. And during the show, we asked Professor Butler about the meaning of the word evangelical.
So when you heard the word evangelical, just like me, you think good news, right? But unfortunately, for a lot of different groups, the good news means you got to sing a certain kind of praise and worship music. The good news means that you can't do your cultural practices the way you might in terms of worship, in terms of belief. The other thing that that means is that you can't be part of movements that are about racial justice. So for instance, let's talk about the ways in which evangelicals talk about Black Lives Matter. They think it's a terrorist group. They think it's this or that or the other. And the problem with that is that why wouldn't you as an evangelical want to see less Black people being killed and respect for African Americans?
And why wouldn't you want to meet Anthea Butler and get her book signed at FFRF's upcoming convention, where she's going to be getting a Champion of the First Amendment Award? That's the weekend, the last weekend of October. You can go to FFRF.org and look for the events section and sign up now, because it's getting to be time. And you can also watch that episode, and she is a firecracker. This is a great, she's a wonderful speaker. You can watch that episode of Free Thought Matters with Anthea Butler right now on our Free Thought Matters playlist on FFRF's YouTube channel.
And if you happen to live in one of the 13 major cities where Free Thought Matters is broadcast on local TV, You can watch the show every Sunday morning. We call it the Un-Sermon. For stations and times to see if you can see the show, check out ffrf.org/freethoughtmatters.
And Dan, briefly, you were in the California Bay Area last weekend, and you met people who watch Free Thought Matters.
Our show actually broadcasts in San Francisco and in Sacramento, and I spoke in both of those cities last weekend.
Oh, people can see it in Sacramento. Oh, that's right. We broadcast in Sacramento, too. Yeah.
So I was giving a talk, and in both talks, somebody said, I watched your show this morning. Well, in Sacramento, it was on Sunday. And they stood up and gave the time and the station and all that. So it's a popular show.
And you were also in San Jose, right?
San Jose as well. Yeah.
And you kicked off the new chapter with Walt Belosky in San Francisco.
Congrats to Walt. 70 people showed up to kick off that first chapter.
Yeah, and so there'll be more about that in our newspaper Free Thought today. And then briefly, we do want to talk about the news. You don't have time to go into much detail, but if you saw the huge expose in the New York Times last Sunday about all the Hasidic yeshivas that get millions and billions of public dollars and refuse to teach secular subjects as required by New York law, we have written a letter to the New York City Council about that, asking them to stop giving money to religious schools. And we were glad to see the baby steps taken by the New York Board of Regents this week following that expose, showing the dire situation and how boys and young men are denied a real education and often subjected to abuse and corporal punishment. So you can look for a blog about that by our attorney, Ryan Jane, at our news link, fffrf.org/news. And then, of course, one piece of good news about the shadow docket, when the Supreme Court takes emergency cases. Very timely this week that on Wednesday, Justice Sotomayor stayed a New York order and what that meant is that a yeshiva university is going to be required to recognize an LGBTQ group while their challenge goes up. And this is a rare instance where a religious plaintiff took a case on the shadow docket emergency order to the Supreme Court where they have not ruled in favor of the religious plaintiff. Then we just want to briefly say that there is terrible news on the abortion front in West Virginia that adopted an almost complete ban on abortion this week. It's the second state since the Dobbs ruling to enact a new ban over massive protests of feminists there. And what will women and pregnant people do in that very poor state? On the good news front, an Ohio judge enjoined Ohio's anti-abortion ban, saying it violates the Ohio Constitution's equal protection clauses, discriminating against women. So it's temporary, but looks promising. And kudos to California for enacting a law to bar digital companies in that state from sharing private information about clients nationwide to do with pregnancy and abortion. And we also want to just comment briefly on Pew's recent study showing that by the year 2020, that the number of 2070, that the number of religiously unaffiliated people will approach or exceed the number of Christians. And this is based on the continual drop we've seen since the 1990s, when 90% of people identified as Christian, and now it's under 70%. And we are seeing the rise of the nuns. So thank you, nuns.
So things are improving.
Yeah, and we have more news that we'll talk about next week.
You've been busy, Annie Laurie, with this secular voters campaign, haven't you?
Yes, and I apologize for the funny noise there. I think it's outside us. We have launched round two of our We're Atheists and We Vote national campaign. Some of you will remember we launched part one around July 4th, our Independence from Religion campaign, in 21 states, and now we have hit the other 29. And these are full-page newspaper ads, mostly in capital cities, but also some of the larger circulation. We're in 45 newspapers on Sunday in this national ad. And then we also have accompanying billboards in many states. And Dan, there's going to be an ad in the Washington Post as well. And it includes, why don't you read the text of
that? Well, it includes one of our very own staffers, Sadie Pattinson, and the caption of the ad, it has her picture there by the Capitol. It notes that Sadie Pattinson is a secular values voter who honors the 235th anniversary of the signing of the godless U.S. Constitution.
And she's pictured in front of the what looks like the U.S. Capitol.
And the ad goes on to say this: I am one of more than 75 million secular Americans who are not religious. The nuns, N-O-N-E-S, those of us unaffiliated with religion, are now 29% of the U.S. population. We are the largest denomination by religious identification. As a secular voter, I trust in reason, science, and America's secular constitution. I want Congress, my state legislature, my public officials, and our courts to keep religion out of government and social policy, keep religion out of public schools, keep religion out of bedrooms, personal lives, and healthcare decisions, including when or whether to have children and whom to love or marry. Use my tax dollars only for evidence-based, not faith-based purposes. If you agree with me, please vote your secular values and please join the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
And we showed a whole bunch of these ads on Ask an Atheist yesterday. You can look for the Ask an Atheist show, and we put it to music. It's really fun to see. I mean, we have 29 participants who are all secular voters, and many interesting stories, including in Arkansas. A couple, Chris Sweeney and Megan McGuire, who are featured in a billboard, two billboards in Little Rock and in the newspaper in the, on Sunday. And they're organizing a Constitution Day event this Saturday in Bentonville because the original Constitution happens to be on display there. And they're going to have a march afterward. We have incredible help. We have an affiliate with Black Nonbelievers from Louisiana. We have a couple in Michigan with who have small children. They're all coming out as atheist humanists and secular voters all around the country. And so we hope that politicians and candidates will take note. Ray Matthews, a former Mormon who's a GOP delegate, is part of our ad. He's going up in a billboard in Salt Lake City, and he's going to be in the Tribune. So it's really been fun. And we did talk with one of the participants, Mandisa Thomas, yesterday on Ask an Atheist when we showed these photographs and stuff. And that was Mandisa Thomas, who represented us in Georgia. She's also in an ad in, going up in the Clarion in Jackson, Mississippi. And she lent her image on these. And so during the show, Dan, what did you ask her?
Well, we had her on Ask an Atheist yesterday, and we're going to talk with her in a couple of minutes here on this show. But during yesterday's show, TV show, I asked Mandisa why she thinks it's important to engage in such secular outreach.
For me, it is very important, for one, to openly identify as a nonbeliever if possible, because people need to know where we stand with our values, and our representatives do need to know that, you know, we live, we work, we organize, we build community. People need to know who we are. I am in the Atlanta area, which is one of the core battlegrounds for civil rights. And so it's important to me, especially with Black history, because as we talk about Constitution Day, when that was signed, my ancestors did not have the right to vote.
Yes.
You know, they had no rights at all. It is important that we exercise this right that so many have fought so hard for, some who even died for. And it would just be a travesty if we did not exercise our civil rights here. But also because the non-religious are now among the largest voting bloc. And as more people start to leave their churches and their religious communities behind, it's important that we are there as leaders and as secular communities to step up and help fill that gap. And people won't know that unless we speak up.
And Mandisa is certainly not shy about speaking up. You can watch that Ask an Atheist on FFRF's YouTube channel by looking for the Ask an Atheist playlist. You can also tune into the live show next week at 12 noon Central on FFRF's Facebook page, where you can ask questions during the show. I think we have time for something else here. Tomorrow happens to be the anniversary of the birthday of the actress Greta Garbo. She was born September 18, 1905. Greta Garbo was not religious. The actress Lily Palmer said that Garbo's daily walks were her religion. Garbo said, I know there are many people who are convinced of life after death, but I haven't been given the capacity for belief.
So let's listen to this sort of coincidentally apropos excerpt of Greta Garbo in the 1933 film Queen Christina, where the pacifist Queen of Sweden is arguing with the warmongering Archbishop.
Now, Your Majesty, would be a good time to send fresh armies and crush these barbarians.
We want to continue what we began in your father's reign until every enemy soldier is disarmed. This is not an ordinary war for treasure or conquest. It is for our faith and for our God.
God is being invoked in many lands these days, Your Grace. What about the enemy's God?
When the enemy invokes God, that is blasphemy, Your Majesty.
I wish I had your confidence, Archbishop.
We have these heretics by the throat. Let us have them on their knees.
Will you slaughter all of contrary faith, Archbishop? You are too ambitious. Spoils, glory, flags and trumpets. What is behind this high-sounding words? Death and destruction. I tell you, I want no more of it. I want for my people security and happiness. I want to cultivate the art of peace, the art of life. I want peace, and peace I will have.
That's the actress Greta Garbo in the role of the pacifist Queen of Sweden arguing with the Archbishop about God and war.
So we're taking a break, but after the break, we will talk in person today with Mandisa Thomas, in person on the phone. We're going to talk about the Women of Color Beyond Belief Conference that Black Nonbelievers is putting on in a couple of weeks in Chicago. Then we'll talk with the UK psychotherapist Jimmy Bangash about how he's dealing with ex-Muslims over blasphemy, apostasy, and discrimination against LGBTQ plus rights. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at FFRF.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers. Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
I am Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we are twice blessed, if I can use that term, to be able to talk with our guest, Mandisa Thomas, the second time this week. We had Mandisa on Ask an Atheist yesterday, and now she's on the phone live with us. Welcome back to Free Thought Radio, Mandisa.
Yay, I'm so glad to be back. Hello again, Annie Laurie.
And Mandisa, of course, is the founder and president of Black Nonbelievers, and she was part of our secular voter campaign. But also, we want you to tell us about the upcoming Women of Color Beyond Belief Conference. When and where, what are all the details?
Awesome. So, yes, this is the third annual Women of Color Beyond Belief Conference that is taking place in Chicago from September 30th through October 2nd. We also are streaming the event online. And this is a conference that features all speakers and producers that are women of color, atheists, humanists, non-religious, et cetera. And we're going to be focusing on reproductive justice this year, especially in the light of the recent SCOTUS decision, and also encouraging people to take part in their civic duties like voting and community work. And so this is a good opportunity for everyone, come one, come all, to hear from these women who are doing some fantastic work. And once again, thank you to the Freedom From Religion Foundation for being our legendary sponsor for this event. It is because of your support that we are able to put on this amazing conference.
Well, that makes us feel really good. And you do all the work. We're just glad you're doing it, you and you have a crew. And so it's taking place, the weekend of September
30th
and Saturday, October 1st and Sunday, October 2nd? And where and when and how do people sign up?
Absolutely. So we will be at the Marriott Chicago Midway Hotel, which is right by Chicago Midway Airport. You can register at wocbeyondbelief.com or you can visit blacknonbelievers.org. And this is a co-production of with Black Nonbelievers, Black Skeptics Los Angeles, and the Women's Leadership Project. And we're also hosting a meal packing project with Go Humanity once the official conference is over. So if you're going to be attending, please do stay to help us feed thousands of families in the greater Chicago area. Or if you can't, you can certainly support, and that information is on our website as well.
And so to talk about some of the speakers, I'm especially interested in the panel that you're going to have on reproductive justice. And you have Tiffany Green, who we love, mm-hmm. who's in the Madison area at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. Charis Horde, whom we love, who was our strategic response intern for almost 3 years. And then Tina Marshall. And who is Tina Marshall?
So, Tina Marshall is our organizer for the Bean of Charlotte, our Charlotte affiliate. She's also the founder of the Black Abortion Defense League. And she and others provide support for women seeking abortion safely and helping to ward off some of the Christians and Christian nationalists who harass the patients seeking safe abortions. So she's been doing some very, very important and wonderful work in addition to her work with Black Nonbelievers and showing that as secular women and women of color, that we are also dedicated to not just talking about reproductive justice, but also doing something about it.
And you have, of course, Candace Gorham will be returning, who she's going to be talking about taking care of our mental health. She's a therapist, and she's also got a book on death, dying, and disbelief. And I see you have a panel on that as well. What else? There's
a lot of new faces this year.
Yeah, BIPOC, Gen Z, secular activists. So if people go to wocbeyondbelief.com, they can also, if they're not able to go in person, then they can stream live. Is that right? They can sign up for that.
Yes, that is correct. We are still in the pandemic, so we are being mindful of people who may not be able to attend in person, and so they will have the opportunity to stream the conference online. And any parts that are missed will be available later on the Black Nonbelievers YouTube channel.
And you're going to be...
Which we do have a...
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
We're almost out of time, but you're going to be doing a workshop on YouTubing, and then there's also going to be... a council member from Palm Desert, My Journey to Becoming Honorable.
Yes.
So it sounds fascinating. We'll see people there.
And anybody can attend, not just women of color. Anybody can show up.
It's come one, come all. So
oh, great.
We encourage everyone to register and attend and support.
Well, thank you
so much, Mandisa Thomas
with Black Nonbelievers. We have to take a break, and then we're going to talk with UK psychotherapist Jimmy Bangash about helping ex-Muslims deal with persecution from blasphemy, apostasy, and discrimination against gay rights. We'll be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Julia Sweeney, and I'm an atheist and former Catholic. I even wrote a play about it called Letting Go of God. Right now, Catholic bishops are using their considerable influence to deny women contraceptive rights. Please join the Freedom From Religion Foundation and help keep church and state separate. You can call 1-800-335-4021, that's 1-800-335-4021, or visit ffrf.org to stand up for true religious freedom.
Margaret Sanger's motto was, "No gods, no masters." This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. Welcome back.
And I'm Dan Barker. Jimmy Bangash is a psychotherapist. He grew up in a traditional Pakistani Pashtun family in the UK. He now works with ex-Muslims and with Muslim heritage LGBTQ in an international context. His current research is exploring how ex-Muslims experience psychotherapy and the effects it has on them. He's a spokesperson for the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain, and he works with other organizations that provide mental health support to the plight of apostates and LGBT in Islamic communities.
And we were very delighted to meet Jimmy Bangash at the Celebrating Dissent conference in Germany last month. And Jimmy and I were on the first panel of the conference discussing blasphemy, Islamophobia, and free expression. And Jimmy, of course, is joining us by phone from London in the UK. Thanks for joining us today, Jimmy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's such a pleasure to reconnect with you again after the conference.
So do you want to tell us your personal story, you know, what it was like to grow up in a traditional family and then become an ex-Muslim and to be gay?
Yeah, sure. Happy to do so. So as you said, I grew up in the UK, in London, and within the area that I grew up, you know, so often what you find is that whichever diaspora it is, whether it's Somalis or South Asians or Iranians, often groups of diaspora will congregate together because it's safer for them to be together as a community and there's familiarity. So our community was a Pakistani and South Asian community where most people were Muslim. Growing up in that community, you know, there was this kind of East and West clash, I guess. So living in the house, it was very much like growing up under the laws and the rules that were Sharia in terms of the rules that we'd have to follow under Islam. You know, things like no alcohol, there would be no pork in our house. There would be expectations of women to do certain things and for men to do other things. The men would have a lot more freedom. We'd have a lot less scrutiny. And the women, conversely, would have a lot more scrutiny. There'd be attention paid to, you know, what sort of clothing they were wearing, where they were going, what time they were going out. And that same kind of scrutiny wasn't applied to the men in our house. But then obviously, because we're in London, we're in the UK, when you would go to school, it's a whole different world compared to the world you were growing up in within your house. But there would always be this kind of internal compass, which would tell me, and I guess many of us who grew up in this situation, that wherever Western ideas clash with Islamic ideas, it is always the Islamic ideas that are correct. So if there was an idea, for example, that men and women might be equal, but Islam actually rather teaches us that, you know, men are the custodians of women, in my mind, it would be definitely that the Islamic ideals were correct and not that the Western ideals were correct. So there's this kind of clash between the two societies causing cognitive dissonance, essentially, in my mind. And that would have carried on. And I think for me, what started happening was Islam began to make less and less sense, and it really started to feel like there was a sense of injustice with it. So primarily in two areas. One of the areas was looking at how women were treated compared to men. So I grew up around quite a lot of domestic violence. My dad was very violent towards my mum. And, you know, I kind of tried to challenge that through an Islamic lens by saying to my dad when I was quite young that, you know, obviously if you're a good Muslim, you shouldn't be beating your wife. And my dad was really transparent about, actually, the Quran says I can beat my wife. And I completely didn't believe him. And then, you know, clearly the Quran does say on certain conditions you can beat your wife. And so that really had me questioning the religion around its validity. And as I was getting older, I was also coming into, you know, more greater consciousness of my sexuality and realizing that I was gay. And Islam is really quite clear about how homosexuals should be treated, and that is, you know, if you catch someone being gay, they should be executed, essentially. For the men, for the women, it is different rules. It's usually around house arrest until they conform. So these two areas really had me kind of questioning the religion, and then essentially, in my 30s, leaving it. What happened around when I was around 23? My family found out I was gay. I was told to leave the family house, and then about 2 years after leaving the family house, I got a promotion at work, which was quite close to where my family lived. So I'd moved to the other side of London, but then I had to move back to take this promotion. And for my family, having me in that vicinity as a gay man was just too much. So what they started doing was ferrying messages across to me via one of my sisters who stayed in contact with me. So all of the boys, like all of my male siblings, kind of disowned me. My dad disowned me. One of my sisters disowned me. But I had one sister and my mum who tried to stay in contact with me. And so through that sister who was in contact with me, my brothers started passing just death threats, really. I guess there's no other way to describe it. They were saying that, you know, we're going to pay someone to kill you. We're going to make sure someone's waiting for you outside your workplace. We're going to find out where you live and get you targeted there.
Wow.
Found out how much it costs to have you to killed. For some reason, I guess I was like 23. For some reason, my sister, I think I was 25 then. For some reason, my sister thought it was helpful to kind of pass these messages to me. To be fair, my sister was, you know, had been equally traumatized by my family through her own journey. She was 8 years older than me, and she's been through some really horrific stuff at the hands of my family. So I had to then get in touch with the police and have a conversation with them about, you know, this is what's going on. If anything happens to me, this is going to be it's going to be an honor crime. It'll be my family who are the people who are attacking me or would have put plans in place. And when I took that step, you know, I think this is a really crucial thing when it comes to honor abuse and honor crime, is it's able to exist so well, so comfortably when it's siloed to the community. The minute we step out of the community and we engage with law enforcement or government bodies or NGOs that are put in place to help protect us, honor abuse often crumbles because it's not set up to deal with opposing structured forces like the police. So as soon as I went to the police, my sister relayed to my family, look, he's gone to the police now. I also sent an email to a number of people whom I knew and who my family knew, saying that this is what's going on, this is what my family are saying they're going to do to me. I want you to know if any harm comes to me, it's at their hands. And that's the other thing with honor abuse. It often thrives in the secrecy and the shadows. But once we bring it into light and we place it under scrutiny, you know, again, it becomes disempowered. So after that happened, my family completely backed off, because obviously no one wanted to get in trouble with the law. And then over the years, I began to see people like Mariam Nemazi and other secularists talking about, you know, being critical of religion, really. But what was, I think, most powerful for me was seeing things like Mariam Nemazi, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, you know, really saying the things about Islam that I'd always been thinking but I'd never really said out loud. And that allowed me to kind of say, you know what, I'm not a Muslim anymore. This religion is quite hideous. It's really homophobic. It's really misogynistic. And I want to be part of that movement that is criticizing it and speaking out loud. Because also there's not really many gay people who speak out about Islam and criticize it. So I guess it was a space for me to kind of step into that, which happened quite naturally.
So, Jimmy, there's we heard at the conference there's a lot of Muslims and ex-Muslims like you who are dealing with similar things. And it seems like that as a psychotherapist that you are now perfectly positioned to be able to give good counseling to others who are experiencing this discrimination and persecution. We have about a minute here. Is that what you've experienced?
Yeah. I think I fell quite naturally into it, like working through my own trauma in therapy led me to want to work as a psychotherapist. And often a lot of my clients are in Muslim-majority countries, so they can't even disclose to a psychotherapist in their own country that they don't believe in Islam because it's illegal in a number of Muslim-majority countries and it carries a death sentence or imprisonment. So when I'm working with people like in Saudi who don't believe in Islam anymore, the thought of them going to a Saudi therapist to talk about this is just not an option. And even if in the West, people have, you know, if you're part of the diaspora community, you're still kind of encumbered by Sharia, even though you're living in a Western liberal democracy. The rules that govern you, the cultural norms in your community and your family, you know, these are still Sharia-inspired and Sharia-compliant rules.
Well, we are talking with Jimmy Bangla about his own story as a gay apostate, as they call them, ex-Muslim, and his family's reaction, but now how he is providing counseling and therapy. And when we come back, Jimmy, we want to talk about a British poll on the Muslim attitude toward gays there and other kinds of transphobia and how people are ostracized. And we'll be right back. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
I'm Dan Barker. We'll be back to talk more with Jimmy Bangash.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker, and we're continuing our conversation with Jimmy Bangash. He's in the UK, an ex-Muslim psychotherapist who is helping others deal with the traumas and the discrimination and the persecution of leaving the faith, being an apostate, and also being LGBTQ in that very homophobic society. Jimmy, at the Celebrating Dissent conference in Germany last month, where we got to hear you talk, there's something you said that I really liked. You said, one way to handle the criticism of religion is with kid gloves, but the other way is to use blasphemy to kick down the door. Do you think blasphemy is a good technique? I think you've actually done that, haven't you?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, that different tools and different techniques have applications for different times and places. So I think if you're looking at something like a protest where you really want to galvanize attention, you really want people to look at what you're doing, and you don't have like a lot of time to grab that attention, well, actually, I think blasphemy is an ideal way to do things. So to give you an example, when we were marching in Gay Pride to the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain in 2017, you know, we had signs that we were holding up because we decided to march in Gay Pride because of what was happening in Chechnya, which is obviously a Muslim area where they had little like concentration camps where they were rounding up gay people, and we were getting reports of parents being told that the authorities were saying to them, you know, if you don't execute your gay child, we're going to pass him back to you in a body bag. So it's much better that you do it.
Wow.
Reports were coming out of Cheshire out of crazy, crazy levels of homophobia. Gay people were saying that they were being hunted down by authorities. People were being trapped using apps and getting beaten up. And, you know, like people were pretending to be gay people on apps. And then when they came and met that person, they were being attacked. So we marched in Gay Pride to say, listen, you know, the homophobia that you see in these parts of the world, whether it's Iran or Saudi or Chechnya, it is because of Islam and its edicts against gay people. And so we're holding signs saying things like Allah is gay, make love, not Sharia. And these kind of really blasphemous signs that, you know, would be see you arrested or attacked in Muslim communities. But obviously Gay Pride is a place that's designed to challenge religious homophobia.
Some of the signs that we could not say on this radio show, for example, you were displaying.
Yes, there were some there as well, right? So I designed that particular sign, actually, as it goes. But what was really interesting was seeing the police descend on us, right? So we had next to us a group that was challenging Christian homophobia with things like Jesus had two dads, right? And the police completely left them alone. But the minute you start criticizing Islam and you do it in a very vocal, transparent, blasphemous way, some would argue offensive, you know, the police were on us and were telling us that, you know, our signs were offensive and we should lower them and we shouldn't march with them. And I think we have to really understand that, you know, offense is no barometer for permissibility of speech, right? Just because something has low levels of offense, it doesn't mean it's okay to say. Just because somebody has some words have high levels of offense, doesn't mean that they have less permissibility to be said. And we really have to move away from that. I mean, we were able to march in Gay Pride that year and have done subsequent years. And there was an investigation into us by Gay Pride, which was about 8 months. And then they realized that we weren't people who are anti-Muslim bigots. We were people who were challenging religious homophobia from those communities. So they agreed to let us march next year, and we even marched this year as well. So I think it's really important, you know, not to do it. Like if you're in a protest, you don't have a long time to be on a panel and speak for an hour.
Right.
In which case you can be really nuanced and sophisticated. You don't want to alienate your audience. But actually, if you're in a protest, you know, you want to galvanize media attention. You want to get your message out there fast. It's important to do it so that it can be seen. And sometimes that involves very provocative, very bold statements.
That's right. But this brings up this whole question that was a recurring theme at the Celebrating Dissent conference, that so many ex-Muslims are automatically branded Islamophobes. And, you know, could you please enlighten our listeners about why being an ex-Muslim and criticizing Islamic teachings is not being an Islamophobe?
Yeah, I think what's really worrying about this screams of Islamophobia is that they often come from liberals, right? People who we would see as our natural defenders of human rights. I wrote an article called Islamic Homophobia is Empowered by Leftist Silence. It was published by Queer Majority, and which is an LGBT publication, but you know, I'm really clear that no other LGBT mainstream publication would ever touch such an article that goes into scrutiny of Islamic homophobia, because that publication wouldn't want to be seen as Islamophobic. And so similarly, this accusation that's leveled at ex-Muslims as us being Islamophobic is you say things that empower the far right, or you say things that stereotype us as Muslims and make people hate us. And we have to be really clear on a distinction here, and that is that Islam is a set of ideas, just like Christianity, just like communism, yeah? And we are absolutely okay to criticize ideas. In fact, ideas require criticism in order to progress. It's that critical assessment of an idea that says, okay, this is useful, this is not useful, this has value, that doesn't have value, this could be refined, this should be thrown away. So looking at ideas through this critical lens and calling out things that, you know, for example, in Islam, that quite frankly I find backwards and barbaric, right? So the idea that you can beat your wife, or that you should, rather, beat your wife under certain conditions, the idea that you should execute gay men, if they are having physical intimacy with each other, you know, I really see that as backwards and barbaric. And it's okay to say this set of ideas is backwards and barbaric. That is very different. That criticism of ideas is very different to criticizing people, yeah? So if you try and say that actually Muslims are backwards and barbaric, you know, that is, you know, really stereotyping a group of people. And that is really bordering on, that is essentially anti-Muslim bigotry. philosophy is Muslim phobia, which is different from criticizing ideas. But what has happened is a word that is used to cross against the two categories has been formed, and that is the word Islamophobia. So the phobia, which you would associate with people like homophobia or xenophobia, you know, this is being afraid of or disgusted with groups of people, you've then attached an idea to it by putting the word Islam next to the word phobia. So you've now got this word which people use to mean you're being anti-Muslim, you're being an anti-Muslim bigot, or you're being Muslim phobic. But when people are criticizing a set of ideas, they still use the same word, which is Islamophobia. So it kind of leaves people in this position where, well, if I say something like this religion is the most homophobic religion on the planet at the moment, you know, a lot of gay people are afraid to say that because they're worried they're going to be leveled with accusations of Islamophobia. And Islamophobia now has kind of become a adjacent word to racist, hasn't it? So because Islam is seen as racialized, if somebody's called an Islamophobe, then they're kind of being called a racist as well. But we have to get back to the basics, which is Islam is a set of ideas, Muslims are people, it is okay to criticize ideas. I'd even take a step further, which is actually when we have statistical data about a group of people that shows that this community has certain ideas, well, then actually it's okay to criticize that group of people using specific, accurate data. Yeah?
Yeah.
So if you run around saying all Muslims are homophobes, right, that's bigoted speech because it's just not true. If you run around saying, actually, in 2017, there was a poll in the UK, and it showed that 52% of British Muslims said that homosexuality should be illegal. Within that same poll, 47% of the Muslims polled said that it's unacceptable for gay people to be allowed to work as teachers. Hmm. And because we know that hand-in-hand misogyny and homophobia, you know, they're often great bedfellows, 39% of the people in that poll also said that a wife should be obedient to her husband.
Jimmy, I'm sorry we're out of time.
Sorry.
So your point is, of course, you can criticize that the majority have this bad idea. So, well, thank you so much for sharing your very compelling and frightening story and all you're doing now as a psychotherapist. Thank you again.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Jimmy Bangas is with the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain. We also want to thank all of you listeners to the show around the country, WOOM in Philadelphia, WZML in Bryn Mawr, WIDE, WMUU in Madison, Wisconsin, WADR in Janesville, Wisconsin, KEOS in College Station, Texas, KZSM in San Marcos, Texas, KOPN in Columbia, Missouri, KEPW, Eugene, Oregon, WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont, WIRIU in Kingston, Rhode Island, and WRFI in Ithaca, New York. Find out more about Freethought Radio at ffrf.org/radio.
And find out more about the new podcast, We Dissent, with female attorneys, including our own at FFRF. And ask for more information, join us. We have so many challenges ahead at FFRF.org, or ask for a sample of our newspaper, Free Thought Today. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker. I hope